Well, hi again. This is Bob Brundage, and today is September the 25th, 2005. And this is a Sunday, and after a busy day, we're talking to Nasser Shuker, currently from Texas, and try to find out a lot about what his life has been about. He's one of the superheroes of the day today, and fostering a brand new square dance program that we want to talk about called ABC. So let's start out first of all, Nasser, where you were born and brought up, and tell us a little bit about life before square dancing.
Now, Bob, I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. They had a old Shumpert Hospital and a new Shumpert. I was one of the first kids born in New Shumpert in 1958. My mother had married a man from Jordan, and when I was about 2 years old, we moved overseas. We were over there about 7 months. And that's when she discovered that life in Jordan just isn't a lot of fun. So she moved back to the small town of Keithville, Louisiana, where I was raised on a farm. We raised chickens and rabbits and hogs, lots and lots and lots of hogs. Went through school in Louisiana. I was late getting into square dancing. I was, I was about 28 years old when I first got into it. I had a computer business. I was a computer programmer, and worked at that for about a year and a half, started my own business consulting firm. My wife at the time had square danced as a child with her parents. One day we went to visit my in-laws, and they said, we're going square dancing, and y'all are going to go watch. And so we went and watched. I didn't want anything to do with square dancing. I knew about it. They'd tried to get me into it for 10 years, but I thought it was clogging. The reason I thought that is that on the Grand Ole Opry on TV, they used to say, when they go to commercial, we're going to have the square dancers dance for you. And then the camera would show them, and it actually was cloggers.
Sure.
But I thought it was square dancers. Then when they came back from commercial, the square dancers were still dancing. They said, wasn't that great square dancing? I knew my feet wouldn't move that fast. They misrepresented it. But when I went to that square dance and I saw my mother-in-law do it, I said, hey, if she can do it, I can too. So we got into a class in Shreveport, Louisiana, and it was fun.
Do you remember who the caller was?
Yeah, the caller, Ed Williams. He was a local caller from Mansfield, Louisiana. What happened, my class in Shreveport only had 5 students. So about 4 weeks into the class, they said, we're going to fold this class. There's not enough to mess with. But Ed was teaching another class in Mansfield, Louisiana, about 25 miles south of where I was living. And so we went each Tuesday night to Mansfield. We enjoyed it. We were in our 20s, and this was our date night. Thinking about the lessons, back then it didn't bother us. We were on a program. It was a 25-week Learn to Square Dance program was in vogue at that time. That's what Ed was using. There were 19 dancers in our graduating class. When they danced the class and club together, typically it was like 7 squares, and this was in a small town of about 5,000 people. We enjoyed it. We started going everywhere, going to dances. I started going to dances before we graduated because my wife at the time was already an experienced dancer, and actually started calling before I graduated too. I had seen the caller, and tried to ask him a little bit about what he did. I started calling Patter.
Yeah.
After about 3 months, where I'd call Patter once a week at the weekly club, he said, well, sooner or later, you're going to have to learn to sing, And I didn't want to. I liked Patter, but he loaned me some records.
Yeah.
The first one I did was The Devil Went Down to Georgia, Gary Shoemake's standard on the...
Right.
On Chaparral.
Yeah. So what time, about what year was this, did you say?
I started, this would have been about 88.
88,
yeah,
okay.
1988.
Right. So who else were your mentors?
Ed Williams, the local caller there, was very helpful. I had had piano or music lessons since I was a child.
Uh-huh.
I remember when I told my mother that I was going to become a square dance caller, and she said, well, at least your music that fortune I've spent in music lessons, at least you're going to make some use out of it. I quickly got hooked up with Wayne Morvant from the Beaumont, Texas area. He actually lives in Silsbee, Texas. What happened, I was in a local callers association, the East Texas Callers Association. Wayne Morvant came by to do a caller seminar. He was an accredited caller coach. He offered all the callers a chance to be critiqued. And there were 31 callers in the association. Only one chose to be critiqued. I remember Ed, I asked Ed if he was going to be critiqued. He said, no. I said, why not? He said, well, last year a caller coach came by and critiqued him, and the caller coach told him, Ed, you need to open your mouth more so people can hear you. Ed said, I've been calling 20 years, and I'm just not going to have someone tell me to open my mouth, you know. Right. So after Wayne Morvant critiqued me, Ed asked me, what did he say? What did he say? I said, he told me, open your mouth more or you end up sounding like Ed. Well, Wayne Morvant kind of took me under his wing and showed me a lot. Prior to that, I'd gone to a caller school with Jack Lazary and Earl Johnston.
Oh, did you?
And I think this was in, that caller school was in 87. That ended up being the last, and I take that back, the caller school was in 88 and ended up being the last one, I think, that Jack taught.
Was it down in Jack's barn?
No, it was in English Mountain in Tennessee.
Yeah.
So it was, that was a good start.
Right. Well, I know you told me in past conversations that you lived in California for a while. Did you?
Yeah, I did. I was in Shreveport most of my life.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line, I moved to Dallas. I was in the computer business.
There you go.
And the computers were really good in Dallas.
Yeah.
I was there about a year. I had a girlfriend in California, and we had a kind of long-distance relationship. But I was looking on the computer, on the internet, and say, okay, for what I do in my computer programming, where's the most money that you can make? You know, I don't care where I live, where's the money? You know, and the money was in California. So.
Right.
So I moved to the San Francisco area and was out there for about 8 years.
Right.
I quit the computer business about the middle of 2000 and just went to call in full time.
Right. Oh, that long ago. No, actually, it was not that long ago, was it? But well, what about some of the other associations you belong to? You mentioned the one in Texas. Did you belong to another one out there in California?
Yeah, I've always supported the Callers Association everywhere I've lived. In Louisiana, they didn't really have a Callers Association.
Oh.
I lived near the Texas border, and I was in
the
East Texas Callers Association, kind of based out of Longview, Tyler, Texas.
Right.
When I lived in Dallas, I was in the North Texas Callers Association. It was based out of there. I was in California, I was in the Square Dance Callers Association of Northern California.
It
was based in that area.
Uh-huh.
And now, where I'm at now in South Texas, we have a Rio Grande Valley Callers Association. So
right.
I try to always, it's really important to support the local activity.
Then when did you get into caller lab?
Caller lab at that time had a requirement where you couldn't vote until you'd been calling, or you couldn't join until you'd been calling 3 years. So the short story is, oh, and you also had to be calling 50 dances a year, averaged over the last 3 years. I was calling 50 dances, or calling regular every week my first year of calling, but on the third year anniversary of calling is when I joined Caller Lab. So that was probably about 92, 91 or 92.
Right.
First convention I went to was in Pittsburgh and has been to everyone since.
Uh-huh.
At my second convention, they put me as the vice chairman of the RPM committee, Recruit, Promote, Maintain. And then one or two conventions after that, I moved up to the chairman of it. I think it was in 96 or 97 I was elected to the board, the Caller Board of Governors.
So, well, you've been had a busy time. So,
real glad to help.
Right. Let's talk about recording. I know you've made several records, and so tell us a little more about that.
Back when Wayne Morvant took me under his wing, At that East Texas Callers Association dance where he was doing the critiquing, I was supposed to call a tip, and then afterwards he would talk to me about it. And during the tip that I called, I did an old record, which was Mickey Mouse on the B-sharp label. Well, Wayne Morvan had heard me. He knew of the record, but he said, hey, I'm going to record that on my record label. And he wanted me to record it, so he gave me the opportunity to record. I was on Rockin' M until the time that I moved to California, and I didn't see any reason to be on a Texas label if I was in California. I was talking to Hi-Hat, which was Ernie Kenney's label, but he was getting up in years and told me he probably wasn't going to be doing it that long. So,
yeah.
So I got with Lumac Records, which was in based in the Seattle, Washington area,
uh-huh.
And had been with them at, for nine national conventions. It doesn't seem that long.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So, well, any aspirations for having your own label?
I've thought about it sometimes. I probably won't. The way the record business has gone, nowadays it's so easy to make copies of the records that there's certainly no money in recording, especially on a Square Dance label. With the numbers shrinking, the economics just aren't there. The one and only reason you do it is for advertisement purposes.
Yeah.
Now, for advertising or for greater advertising, it seems to me to make the most sense to be with a bigger group, to be part of a bigger group.
Right.
You'd rather have part of a larger advertisement than all of a smaller advertisement,
right.
I think.
Yes. Wade Driver told me one time, I asked him about owning a record company, he said, well, anybody can do a record. If you got $500, you can get a record. And if you got $5,000, you can get a record company.
Yeah. Yeah. That, unfortunately, I know when I first started, if a record sold 300 copies, you'd get your money back. If it sold like 500 to 600, you had a hit.
Yeah.
And the first one I did, Mickey Mouse, sold a lot. I think they told me it sold like 2,500 or 2,700, which was a lot. But now, I mean, records are good. You sell 150 of them, you consider yourself
right.
Lucky. Part of that is because even though the Caller Lab Code of Ethics says, you know, don't copy these records, they still do it. And I don't know any way to... It's not just Square Dance records that are copied.
Right.
Even, you know, Paul McCartney and Britney Spears and all these great recording stars, their music is copied all the time.
Sure.
It's just the way the world
well,
has changed.
Well, it's so easy with in the iPod or something like that. Thing.
Press a button and it's copied.
Okay, yeah. What's your take on the MP3s and CDs and vinyl and all this jazz? You were talking about it the other day, you and I.
Well, I was so glad to see... the music become of a better fidelity. Vinyl's really a low fidelity type of music. Every time you play that record, it wears it out just a little bit. Of course, with the new CDs, MP3 files, those never wear out, so you have good sounding music. And people nowadays, they go to discos, and they go to theaters, and they go to rock concerts and things, and they're used to hearing high fidelity music, so I'm
right.
Really glad to see Square Dancing.
Yeah.
Take shape. I love it when I'm traveling somewhere and tell people I'm a Square Dance caller, and they say, well, where do you carry your fiddle, you know? I carry my fiddle. It's all on my computer. And they're fairly impressed.
Yeah, right. I know the last few dances that I went with a young kid would come up to me and say, well, what, where'd you get that music? I was playing a 45 RPM, and they couldn't understand it.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody today would still be using a 45. But,
yeah, today's kids.
They're still in use, though.
They are. Yeah, there'll always be 45s. Tom Dillinger was telling me there are enough jukeboxes that use 45s that they'll always be pressing 45s just for that one market.
Right.
Just to fill up those jukeboxes. You know, every time right. George Strait makes a country hit, you know, they have to put it in all the jukeboxes in the world. And there's still thousands.
What percentage of callers use 45?
You know, I don't have a feel for that, except one of the record producers was telling me that most of their sales are 45s.
Are they?
Like 90% of their sales are still 45s. Part of that could be that it's real hard to duplicate a 45. when they sell one CD, they really, because of copying, they, you know, 30 callers get to use that music from that one sale.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of callers use 45s.
Okay. What's your experience calling overseas?
I love to call overseas. In a way, it's my experience has been, I first got a chance to call overseas. I somehow lucked up and got hired to call a festival in Saudi Arabia. What happens when you call in Saudi Arabia, they ask you, you know, who's some other callers that you like. And so that determines who they'll get next year. And the guy that was just in Saudi Arabia before me was Jack Plattes from Cincinnati. And he recommended me highly. I had a chance to call in Saudi Arabia, and on my record label was another caller from Sweden. So I worked it out where I'd fly, like, it seemed to me like I'd never get booked to call in Sweden, but I'd fly, like, to Sweden, which is kind of halfway to Saudi Arabia, and then call there and then go to Saudi Arabia and hit two or three places with that same trip.
Right.
And also on that same trip, I think I called in England. So that was my first time to call overseas in 98. And I've been, that first trip overseas was like 7 days of calling, and then I went back and some people liked me and had like 10 days next, and then 15. And I had a trip where it was one trip overseas, it was like 35 days. That's a long time to be over there, so I busted up into two trips a year.
Right.
You know, and now currently I'm going over there about three times a year.
Oh, yeah.
And okay. I just love it. Compared to the USA, the dancers are usually younger. It's special when an American caller comes over there and calls. It's,
sure.
For the most part, the dancers learn the calls quite thoroughly. The callers can call anything you can think of, and they can do it. Plus, it's just fun to go over there.
Yeah. Have you had any experience with non-English speaking countries?
Oh, yeah, that was fun. I called one time in the Czech Republic, and this poor little guy, he was about 22 years old, and can't even pronounce his name. It's got some letters in it that we don't have. And, he picked me up at the airport. He had read about me on the internet. I was kind of like his idol or something. It was strange. We're driving down the road and in his car. He's weaving all over the road because he's looking at me, you know, like he can't really believe this American caller's in his car. And he was a college kid, and I was scared to death, you know, we were weaving all over the road. When we finally got there, I told him, you're a great driver. He just beamed, you know. He just thought that was wonderful. But they spoke hardly any English there. They appointed a young lady in her early 20s to be the interpreter because she spoke the most English, and it was one or two words. But it was enough to get by. But at the time of the square dance, they knew all the calls. They danced beautifully. In the Czech Republic, it seems to me the average age of the dancers is the early 20s.
Uh-huh.
So square dancing started in the universities there.
Oh, yes.
And it's really beautiful to call over there.
Right. How about China, Japan? Or?
I've not done Asia. I need to do Australia and China, Japan.
Well, okay. One of the questions I ask everybody, you asked me one time in our conversation this weekend is, do you have any regrets? Is there anything you wish you'd done differently so far?
You know, really the only thing is I wish I'd have got into it younger. I dallied around until I was in my mid to late 20s. And I'm thinking of all the time I watched, what did I do before square dancing, you know? And I watched The Dukes of Hazzard, and I watched for recreation, you know, watched Who Shot J.R., you know, on that Dallas show. And all that seems so meaningless, where all the people I've met through square dancing seem so meaningful. So I would have to say my only regret is that I didn't start it 10 years before I did.
Yeah.
Just didn't.
Right.
It's all a matter of timing.
Yes, that's true. Well, where do you think square dancing has been? Where is it now, and where is it going?
Well, that's a big question. Good question too. I don't know that anyone really knows the answer. I know in Caller Lab, and I've been on the board for most of 10 years, and just really been concerned about the future of the activity. There was a landmark publication written, I believe, in the year 2000 by a Harvard professor, that Robert Putman, and the book was called Bowling Alone,
yes,
The Decline of Social Capital, right, in America. Social capital, as you know, is where you develop friends, you do social activities. And so it's an alarming thing. Where are all these people that used to square dance and used to bowl and used to be in badminton clubs and croquet clubs and gardening clubs? Well, they're all on the internet, or they're watching 1,000 channels of cable TV. So I read Putman's book with interest. Just to summarize, his solution was to say that there's fewer and fewer people that join activities, so we need to market to the people who are joiners, and like go market square dancing to people in a gardening club, or go market square dancing to people that's in a bridge club to play bridge. Or my take on that is those people are already busy. They're, someone in a bridge club is as unlikely to become a square dancer as I am to become an avid bridge player, you know, because those people are already busy.
Good thought.
And I see where the world has changed, and the whole focus of the Square Dance ABC is that the product that we offer in the modern Western square dancing, we basically offer a year of lessons. This is our product. If someone wants to square dance but they want less than that, we really don't offer them a product. Worked real hard on this Square Dance ABC to try to come up with a product for the average guy out there where everyone can experience square dancing on their terms. I've liberally used the Color Lab market research. Over the last 5 or 6 years, Color Lab has spent a ton of money on market research. I'm very thankful to them for doing that. The market research shows that people will buy a square dance. They'll try it. People are willing to try a square dance. They're just not willing to join clubs and take lessons and have a huge commitment. Square Dance ABC is all about giving people the square dance on their terms.
Okay, well, then it's up to you to describe the ABC program to us.
The thing on ABC, and again, what the market research shows, that people would try square dance, and understand that in the modern Western and the mainstream plus world, we really don't have a product to sell to people. Our product is a year of lessons, and you can only buy it 2 or 3 days a year, and that's the only time you can buy it. So there's the fallacy to that. But the market research shows square dancing has a positive image, and square dancing has tremendous brand loyalty. And if it's pitched as something that's healthy and fun and social, that people will try it. More than half of the people are willing to try it. Where Square Dance ABC came in, we were having an internet discussion maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and someone, I credit it to C.J. Smith, who's a challenge caller out on the West Coast. I believe she was the one that came up with the idea that you could go around like to different bars, okay, and you could get friendly with the people and say, hey, I want to show you something, and show them a few square dance moves, show them maybe 5 or 6 square dance moves, and then make a little circuit, go to a different bar the next night or the next week. 3 or 4 weeks later, you're back at that same bar where you were before and say, hey, I want to show you something. This is cool. This is square dance. And they'll say, well, we've already seen that. Say, no, I'll show you something different. Show them another 5 moves different from what they had the first time, okay? Then after you made that circuit 3 times, they have had 15 to 20 moves, okay? So then if they wanted to join a class, it was not like starting from the very beginning. They were had a real good head start into the class. So the idea popped into my head that callers do one-nighters all the time. One-nighters are where you assume that these people have never square danced before and that they'll never square dance again. But every caller has a different one-nighter. Just like I was talking to you, and you start with, was it left foot is one step? No, you start with patty cake polka. I start with something different. We talk to another caller, they start with something different. But every caller has a one-nighter that works, a one-nighter being a way to get people that's never square danced before to get them dancing. So if we could come up with a series of one-nighters, then people could learn square dancing in these 3 small doses that they could take in any order. And the fundamental difference is that they go up to the next level not by taking lessons, but by taking dances, by dancing dances. So for the first time ever, we're selling dancing instead of lessons. That's the innovation of where ABC is at. And the idea has been met with tremendous acceptance.
Well, it certainly has. I think it might be the salvation of square dancing. I think you believe that same way.
I do. One thing that's puzzled me over the years, Bob Howell from Ohio, when he first met me, he's always called me the Messiah. You're going to save square dancing. I think he may have been saying it in jest, you know, over the last 14 or 15 years. And I don't really want credit for this, you know, because he can't really do it without, you know, without everyone's help. But it is time for square dancing to evolve from a year-long set of lessons to where people accumulate experience by taking dances. This is kind of, you know, look at anything that's popular, the Harry Potter series, okay? So there's a series of how many books? Is it six books or however many's in the series? I don't even know how many it is. But see, you could enjoy the fourth book without ever having read the first three.
Right.
Then if you like the fourth one, say, man, this is real good stuff. I'm going to read the fifth one. Or maybe I'll read the second one. The thing is that you can enjoy them in any order.
Right.
And then once you've had all six, you know, then you're a full-fledged Harry Potter fan club. But the tremendous power of it is that each one is a standalone experience. And that's the power of the ABC thing.
Right.
Even the world changed. They used to do mini-series on TV. Do you remember when they did these mini-series and you'd have to watch it every week for like 6 weeks? To the best of my knowledge, they don't do that anymore.
Right.
The world is not into this sequential thing.
Yeah.
Anything you watch on television, for the most part, you can watch it, the set, in any order.
Right.
You know, these episodes. So.
Right.
This is where we're headed. Three dances you can take in any order. And then some of those people will become interested and they'll want to take a year-long class. Well, we offer that to them. If they want it, we have it. But for a marketing tool, ABC is definitely it.
Well, do you propose that supposing someone over a six-week period has managed to get through C, B, and A, and not necessarily in that order, do you then try to promote them into a club, or are you proposing that there should be ABC dances from now on?
Yeah, the ABC being an entry program for today's busy people, what I propose is that a caller get a hall and divide it into two time slots. For example, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday night would be an intro to square dancing for people, no experience is required. So it's for new dancers, it's for brand new dancers, it's for experienced dancers, it's for anyone that wants a square dance. You're selling a square dance. You're selling fun, fitness, and friendship instead of selling a class, okay? So this is where brand new people can come in at any time. Once they come in, you give them some kind of a card or a sticker, or you punch a hole in a card, or you somehow indicate, and you tell them, look, this is ABC, and tonight we're doing the B dance, okay? And there's three in the set. There's three slightly different square dances, so collect the set, you know? Some will come back next week. Some will come back eventually, okay? After they've collected all three, they're eligible to go from 8 to 9:30 p.m. in the same hall, which is the combined ABC dance that consists of about 22 calls. Not everyone's going to want to come back three times, but we find that enough of them are going to want to, you know, to make the ABC dance a worthwhile thing. These people are not going to be avid square dance enthusiasts that want to come every week and learn the latest challenge move and all this stuff. The people want to square dance for fun, fitness, and friends. This then will feed the existing activity. And that's kind of another thing that's the beauty of ABC. We're not proposing any changes to Mainstream and Plus. And part of that reason is that Caller Lab has been trying to change it for 30 years. And it's time to give up the idea that it's going to change enough to make it attractive to brand new people. So I do see a trickle-up effect from ABC. There's a separate population of dancers.
Right.
Enough of those will want to go into Mainstream Plus, but the vast majority won't. You'll still get more into the existing clubs than you would have got without ABC. But please understand that the vast majority of people have no interest in taking a year of class.
Right. But you're going to have to continually recruit all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, and we're working. We've got some ideas that we're generating on that. There's ways which we talked about just this last weekend, of trying to come up with a series of fundraisers where you approach a church or a civic group, a Lions Club, a PTA group, a Boy Scout troop. There's just hundreds of different groups you could approach and say, hey, you want to have a fundraiser? Sell tickets to this square dance. And your date for your square dance is November the 12th of 2005. That's your date. Here's your tickets. Sell your tickets, and you keep half the money and give the other half to us, and we'll give you a heck of a square dance. What a deal. Everyone needs a fundraiser. This puts you 100 salesmen out there selling this square dance instead of just one. I see that as a powerful idea that's pretty much unlimited in potential.
Right.
So you always have new people in. As new people come in, get their name and address, you know, hey, you're interested in learning more about square dancing. But understand that when they come in the door, they're not going to become a plus dancer. Some will, but the vast majority won't.
Right.
Explain to them, this is ABC, you've had one dance, collect the set, offer it to them, but if they don't want to, don't force them. You know, don't just let them have it on their terms. When you occasionally start a class every 3 months using multi-cycle, if you start a class every year, promote that class to your existing base of ABC people.
Yeah.
A certain percent of them, 10%, 15% of them will choose to take a class, you know, and go up the levels.
But in the meantime, these ABC dances are still going on.
I think so. It's a product for the community.
Right.
A square dance.
So, because, you know, we old-timers think. Sorry about that. The tape stopped unexpectedly, and I was just talking about back in the old days, in the 40s and so forth, we used to, my own hometown, maybe 30,000, 40,000 people, there could be two dances every Saturday night. Two different callers, two different bands, and the whole thing. And, of course, there was, in those days, we didn't have what there is to do today, obviously, but... these were always continuing things, and it was always a repetitious thing, too. I mean, we did the same dances every night with very little variation in program, except from caller to caller, right? But, I mean, my program, just like my one-night stand program, I could recite it to you verbatim because it's what I always do, if you follow me. So, it's been interesting. You've had a real busy weekend here, Nasser. You called three dances yesterday, right?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, I know an awful lot of people around, a lot of the callers around, the full-time callers, these guys in the RV parks and so forth, they're calling four dances a day. I was always happy that the most dances I ever called in a year was 265. And I thought that was quite an accomplishment, but you do that in about 3 months.
Yeah, it's kind of a different business down there.
Sure.
Where the square dance activity has become fractionalized, so the caller, well, just like this last weekend, we had a dance that was a mainstream dance, we had an advanced dance and a plus dance all on Saturday. But that's the way the promoters here in Albuquerque had set it up. They set up a something for everyone weekend.
Right.
That's kind of the way they do in the Rio Grande Valley. All the programs down there are caller run. And typically you have like a beginner class, and then you have a mainstream dance, and a plus workshop, and the A1 class, and the A2 dance. And they end up running 12 to 14 dances a week. And some guys are doing even more than that. I know Jerry Justin out in Yuma, he does 14 or 15 square dances a week, plus he also does a full round dance program. So he's
right.
A very busy guy.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I talked to Jerry Hilt, also in Cincinnati, he's averaging about 12 dances a week. And obviously he's been doing ABC for years.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. He's got a club that's limited to nine basics. The club dances nine. The first, I think it's the first nine basics. I don't know which nine basics it is,
right.
But as you well know, that guy's amazing. He can do more with less than any guy I've ever seen.
Right. Did you ever hear him do progressive squares?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's well known for that. In fact, I was calling in the Cincinnati area. I do progressive squares also. I do mine a little different than he does, but I did progressive squares. Several dancers came up to me afterwards and said, man, you got a lot of guts doing progressive squares in Jerry Helt's hometown.
Yeah. Well, I saw Jerry at one of the nationals with 64 squares that had been pre-programmed so that there would be no walkthrough or anything. And I tell you, the amazing thing to me that was he stopped after a paddock call and he said, now if you look around, he said, you'll find your partner is dancing with your current partner is dancing with your partner, his partner or her partner. And everybody's looking around and said, oh yeah, I agree. And then he called, of course, a singing call, and the last call he came cross trail through probably, and Alaman left, and 64 squares hit it on the nose.
I've caught it before with 40 squares, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's rare nowadays to have a crowd that big.
Yeah.
I guess the biggest this year, I had 25 squares at the Utah State Convention.
I told you about my biggest dance.
Today. Yeah, he did. He said it was like 300 squares.
Right.
That's amazing.
Omaha.
Might get that in a year.
1958.
That was great.
Well, this has been an interesting conversation, Nasser. I really appreciate your taking the time to sit down and chat with me tonight. And I
appreciate what you're doing for the history of square dancing.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun. I've covered about 130 different callers now, run dance teachers. Some people are not even callers, they're just dance leaders. People like Jim Masco, for example.
Sure.
You know, but so it's a little contribution I've made. I'm happy to do it.
I sure appreciate you doing it.
Okay. Well, let's call this an evening, and thanks again, and have a safe trip. I hope you didn't get blown away down there in Texas, and I hope you find everything, all your friends down that way.
Look forward
to it. Safe and sound.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, thank you, Nasser.